Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closest to the stars, episode 230 of Columbia Calling. A real landmark, 230. There were periods back there when I thought I was going to, close up shop and stop this just because I didn't get any emails from people, but we persevered. And one of the reasons we persevered is that, we do get feedback, and we get feedback from the strangest places. And so that's why I'm going to introduce my very special return guest today, Santiago Giraldo, who those of you who have been listening from the very beginning will know that I think in the first 10 episodes, I'll have to check online, Santiago was on this on the show talking as the director of for Latin America of the Global Heritage Fund, and we talked about the Ciudad Perdida, or the Lost City. So we were talking about the Lost City, and it was a very popular show and probably one of the first shows that really gave us a hook that people wanted to come back and listen to. And now, out of the blue, well, not really out of the blue, I get an email from Santiago, so let's say 220-something episodes later, several years later, saying, I've heard about, or I've been referenced on Columbia Calling by people who I've haphazardly met. One was Navarro Lowry, who was on the show a couple of episodes ago, who happened to be on the same flight sitting next to Santiago down to Bogota. Another person up in the Ciudad Perdida, so up there in this living ruin. It's very flattering. So we got back together and we're here on the show together. And well, Santiago, thank you for this positive feedback of running into people who've listened to Columbia Calling.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show again.
It's a real pleasure. And it's very flattering for me for you to write and say, well done. People are actually referencing it. It was so long ago, but there was a good rapport and it was a good conversation. And I think that conversation stands the test of time, and therefore that's proven. But you've... you're still the director. We're going to catch up with what you've been up to in the last few years. You're no longer in the beautiful area of Quinta Camacho, where the offices were. We're now sort of off the 85, a nightlife office. In fact, my medical, my doctors are based around here, off the Calle 85. But you're still the director for the Global Heritage Fund in Latin America. And now you're the director of ProSierra, about the Sierra Nevada, two things that do link. Well, tell us what you've been up to in this last couple of years.
Absolutely. Well, since we last spoke, we've been wrapping up the Ciudad Perdida project. Mm-hmm. And that involved, we're actually still wrapping up, and we're finishing up the ticket booth mm-hmm. at Ciudad Perdida, which is going to aid us in controlling visitor flow.
Okay.
Because we've been getting more and more visitors on a yearly basis. We're still very... reasonable, so to speak. We're at 48, 49% carrying capacity, but we're now getting almost 24,000 people per year.
24,000 people per year, making it one of the top visited sites in Colombia.
Yes, and it's still ranked within the Lonely Planet guides and within photos and what have you as one of the must-dos in Colombia. But given the numbers, it's best to set up a ticket booth and actually be able to control the amount of people that go into the site on a daily basis, which is right now capped at 120 people.
120 people per day. And it's a five-day thing, so there's several hundred on the trail at any one time.
Yes, and it's very reasonable. If you compare it to Machu Picchu or Angkor or any of these huge sites where the main emphasis has been on piling in person after person after person into the site, and that's been detrimental to the whole experience. So that's why we're trying to be very careful.
Now, this ticket booth, it's going to be at the base, or it's at the entry?
At the end of the staircase.
At
the end of the staircase.
So as before you ascend?
Actually, after you ascend from the river, and right before the first cluster of terraces, that's where it's going to be located.
Right. And you'll have a register of obviously visitors, where they come from, passport numbers, who they've come with, and do they have to pay a fee there?
Yes, only if they haven't paid the fee within their outfitter.
But the outfitter presumably pays the
fee. It's usually the outfitters pay the fee. We've got some outfitters who every once in a while forget to do so. And in that sense, because revenue is so important for conservation, actually, that's why the Colombian Institute of Anthropology and History is being very careful with that money.
Well, that's good. But I think these outfitters probably conveniently forget, taking a little tip for themselves. Don't name names.
No names to be named, but out there, we know who they are.
So this ticket booth, I mean, it will be a respectfully placed cabin, I guess.
Yes, it's a small cabin-like structure. We sourced the wood locally, of course. And because we had a hurricane go through Ciudad Perdida, Hurricane Matthew, in October of 2016, so we had over 450 trees that were toppled down by the hurricane. And so we used quite a bit of that wood, and we've been harvesting that wood to do rehab work at the park.
Well, it makes sense.
So it's locally sourced. It was designed by one of our architects that works closely with the park. And it's a low-key, nicely designed booth so that, people can just...
It's not going to hinder photographs.
No. Absolutely not. That was one of the main premises.
It has to be. It can't be, sort of sat there in the middle of it. What is the price then for people?
Right now, it's 50,000 pesos.
This is very cheap.
Which is very reasonable.
Yeah.
Very reasonable.
Is there a difference between Colombians and foreigners?
No. One of the interesting things with the Colombian Institute of Anthropology and History, and remember, I used to work there, is that the institute decided to adopt a flat fee policy versus, say, what the Park Service in Colombia charges, on the basis that, we're all human beings. And in that sense, it was simply easier and made more sense administratively also to have a flat fee. So it's just 50,000 pesos. And then, of course, you pay your outfitter whatever it is.
Whatever they're charging, and whatever that spiral of competitiveness that they have between the
two. Exactly.
I think that the number of 24,000 is highly commendable. But I mean, since I was there in 2001 or something like that, it was a trail, and I forded seven times the same river. But you've made bridges now, and I imagine the trail's been widened and protected, and so it doesn't actually, deplete the foliage around the walk.
Yes, there's been quite a degree of investment in infrastructure, not only by us, but also by the indigenous community and by the campesinos. And in that sense, some of it has been well placed.
Yeah.
Other things have not been so well done. At one point, the campesinos decided that they wanted to widen up the road, And so we have that issue. Mm-hmm. But in general, there's been quite a degree of investment mm-hmm. in infrastructure. And the trail is wider now. And in certain places where the crossing was very iffy and we've had accidents, mm-hmm. so there's been shoring up of slopes and adding walkways mm-hmm. and adding railings and that sort of thing to improve safety.
Making it a world-class hike, a world-class yes. park, let's say, a sacred place to think, which is what was needed, definitely. And with 24,000 people, you need to have it well-maintained. Now, before we sort of go into other subjects, and I know that some of my listeners, well, long-time listeners and, you know, maybe first-time listeners, but let's get out of that. There's no security issue for anyone hiking with, like, say, paramilitary groups, groups, but guerrilla groups. We need to get that out there so people know that area is
none
safe.
None whatsoever. And we've actually had no issues since 2007, mm-hmm. since the paramilitaries demobilized. Mm-hmm. And we actually have a platoon from the Colombian Army that's stationed permanently at Ciudad Perdida.
There you go.
And in certain cases, they actually provide not security services as such, but they aid where... say we've got an accident mm-hmm. and we had an accident about 3-4 months ago mm-hmm. and so they will radio in and the helicopter, if it's available, will fly into Ciudad Perdida and pick up the person that had the accident mm-hmm. and medevac them out.
Like a broken leg.
Knees. Yeah. Some people fall, hit their heads on stones. Yes.
Well, this is excellent because this is what, you know, let's use this post-conflict, post-accord armed forces will need to direct their energies towards this sort of engineering projects, social things, building, you know, where this is where their energy should go, I think, of course. And so I think that's an excellent step forward. And so are there any other, besides the ticket booth, are there any other big plans in the pipeline for the Ciudad Perdida?
No, right now we're wrapping up. We've been focusing mostly on conservation. Mm-hmm. Because we have a hurricane come through and topple down all those 450 trees, we had quite a bit of structural damage.
Yeah.
So we had about 18 terraces that were damaged.
Huh.
And so for the past 2 years, we've been focusing on doing conservation work for those structures and just shoring up the walls mm-hmm. and redoing the pathways and all this sort of thing that really, really was sorely needed right after the hurricane came through. So it's been a combination of conservation work and administrative infrastructure at Ciudad Perdida, and then a bit of development work as well, but that was done in the Don Diego Basin, where mm-hmm. we finished a school for the Kogi community
nice.
That lives in the town of Ableji.
Mm-hmm. It's unusual for hurricanes to come through this area. I mean, We get the tail.
But
heavy winds and heavy rains, but the actual hurricane. Now, that was Matthew. You said it was mm-hmm. 2016.
October,
so when we were supposed to be out voting for the referendum.
Oh,
it was
yes.
the same date, so people yes. couldn't vote on the Colombian Caribbean coast because of the hurricane.
Exactly.
So exactly. Put that into context.
That is exactly right.
To put it into context,
that's exactly what happened. And I started getting calls from Ciudad Perdida going like, the wind gusts are horrible. The side of the mountain looks like a gigantic tiger had just raked its claws through the forest. So it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
So we've been concentrating on that. And that's simply to wrap up the 8-year project that I directed for Global Heritage Fund and with the Colombian Institute of Anthropology and History.
Right. But so will that mean you're moving on after this 8-year project?
Right now, what JHF is doing is that it's looking for new projects.
Yes.
And we are doing some scouting work in Honduras, mm-hmm. at Copan.
Oh,
and we're currently funding an investigation in Santiago de Cuba, actually.
Oh, really?
Because the 12 Catholic churches that are located in Santiago de Cuba, of course, colonial times in Cuba go up to 1898, so it's a very long time period. So some of the churches were built in the 1530s, 1540s, 1550s, and so we're funding the historical investigation that is going to be the baseline to do the restoration and conservation work.
Nice. So they've taken off Colombian projects and moved elsewhere.
Well, it was a good run. It was 8 years. It was 8 years, and the board was saying, you know, we think we've done enough for the time being. It doesn't mean that if donations come in, they will, of course, be directed towards Sudamérica. But what it does mean is that we're not actively looking for funding.
Mm-hmm. And these repairs, like some of you're doing the repairs to the tableaus, the platforms, and so on, you do them with the local indigenous community, I'm sure.
Sure. One of the things that we do is that we have a conservation team.
Mm-hmm.
And so depending on who's available for the conservation season, we will have the core team, and then we will have people that we try out.
Mm-hmm.
With the Kogi population, it's been a bit difficult because sometimes what happens is that if we hire someone, they will come in with their whole family.
Yeah.
And we can't really feed the whole family. So it becomes a bit of a bummer. And then there's another aspect, which is that they have lots of meetings.
Yeah.
They have lots of reunions. And so sometimes we'll be working with someone, and our conservation field seasons will be 20, 30 days. And so every once in a while, they'll say like, oh, I've got to go. And then they won't come back. But of course, it simply depends on who it is.
This is meetings. I think we discussed this in the first one. It's the Colombian reunionitis.
Yes.
That there is this need for meetings here. But again, we won't get into that.
Which is a bit of an OCD thing. I mean, we love our meetings.
Yeah, it's you know, Google Agenda and Google Calendar was made for Colombia.
Yeah, absolutely. But the corollary is that they never go anywhere.
No.
Nothing ever gets accomplished at a Colombian meeting.
Because the first 20 minutes you've got to talk about family, and then you might then get into it, but then it's in the coffee break, and then it's like, nah, it's meetings. Never mind. Let's not get into that. Well, we're talking to Santiago Giraldo. This is the director of the Latin American branch of the Global Heritage Fund and the director of ProSierra, and we'll talk more about ProSierra in the next segment of this show and find out what they're doing up there in the Sierra Nevada, which, as I know, it's a visited area. You know, when you go to Santa Marta and you go to Cienega Grande and around Barranquilla up to Isla Salamanca and stuff, it's all connects with the Sierra Nevada, of course, Minca too, so an incredibly touristic area and very delicate and in great need of, let's say, protection and, I'd say, you know, an organized conservation plan. So I think that's what we'll end up discussing in the next segment of this episode 230 with Santiago Giraldo. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall talking to Santiago Giraldo. And of course, you'll know he's the director of the Global Heritage Fund for Latin America and the director of ProSierra. Basically, we need to know what ProSierra is before we commence.
ProSierra is one of the older environmental NGOs in Colombia. It was founded in 1986.
Wow.
And it came about as a spin-off of the Ciudad Perdida project. So a good number of people who had worked at the Ciudad Perdida project initially decided that they wanted to set up a foundation that whose mission was to protect the natural and cultural heritage of the Sierra Nevada, Santa Marta, writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, they started setting up pretty ambitious conservation projects.
Right.
From 1986 onwards. And I've been the director for the past 7 months.
Uh-huh.
Just about. And we do a good number of things. For one, we try and concentrate on conservation projects. So natural conservation projects within the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta and its area of influence, because we also work in the Beja region.
Mm-hmm.
We do, as we were discussing earlier, quite a bit of the biodiversity offset work for the mining companies that operate in the Jaguaririco area.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do that sort of thing. Right now, we're in conversations with Riqueza Natural, which is a USAID-funded project that is trying to concentrate on preserving dry tropical forests, which we have very few relics of dry tropical forests available in the Sierra Nevada Santa Marta and the surrounding area. So they're trying to do as most they can to preserve these areas of dry tropical forest. We're also in conversations with Pantera Colombia, because what we're trying to set up are these conservation corridors through which jaguar and puma can actually move around throughout a very broad landscape. And we are also the operators of the Santa Marta and Cienega Water Fund. So we are trying to channel quite a bit of investment into water infrastructure for the northern side of the Sierra Nevada.
That's ambitious stuff, and it's stuff from the very beginning here. Dry tropical forest, where am I likely to see that? Is that what's up above Taganga type of thing, that scrub?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It's like a Sherrick scrub, is that
there,
it?
It's a Sherrick scrub, but it's also, when you move towards more humid areas, mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing that you'll see, say, if you fly into Santa Marta mm-hmm. and you look towards the mountains mm-hmm. on your right-hand side for the most part, that's the sort of forest mm-hmm. that is the dry tropical forest. And there's very few patches of forest remaining. And so because it's one of those crucial habitats for a number of endemic bird species and for not only bird species but also for a number of species in general, it's been considered one of the more important targets for conservation efforts.
And it's endangered. We know it's, you know, it needs to be protected. But if you were just a local person, let's say a lay person, you'd just think it was scrub that needs to be cleared for your cattle farming. It looks like that. Because you don't look at it and it doesn't inspire you, sort of thing. It's not as inspirational as like the verdant rainforest
right.
or something.
Especially during the dry period,
yeah.
it just looks like kindling.
Yeah.
But once the rains come in, they become areas that are absolutely crucial for protecting river basins mm-hmm. and for protecting water infrastructure. We've got little spotted cat. We've got ocelot living in there. We've got any number of birds. And they do protect those areas that are very vulnerable to erosion against soil damages.
And, of course, this protects, they would then protect Santa Marta and the surrounding urban areas. I mean, this is your barrier.
This is your barrier against landslides, soil erosion, soil depletion, and general loss of biodiversity.
Yeah, definitely. Right, so that, to put it into context there. Now, 1986, Pro Sierra starts, Colombia was a different, let's say, prospective place to come and visit. And the Sierra Nevada as well, and that area. I mean, did they actually do any work in 1986, or was it just a nominal organization? We're here, but we're not here.
No, it was actually, they started doing quite a bit of work.
Okay.
Because what started happening was that they started working very closely with the Colombian government.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the main issues in the Sierra Nevada Santa Marta, as probably some of the listeners know, is that there's quite a high degree of administrative friction.
Mm-hmm.
As is usual in Colombia, and this is one of our MOs, is that everyone keeps to themselves.
Okay.
And so because the Sierra is divided in three departments, and it's got one national park, and it's got three governor's offices as well, and it's 33 basins and any number of municipalities, well, it makes things rather complicated. And so one of the things that ProSierra pioneered was to try and actually control egos,
mm-hmm.
for one, and work hand in hand with local communities, be they indigenous or campesinos, to actually come about conservation agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they actually began doing much of the heavy lifting, which was trying to sit people down and tell them, look, you know, this is a strategic ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
The population in the area depends on the water that flows out of the Sierra Nevada Santa Marta. So we actually have to sit down and come together and come to agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be simply on the government side. It can't be on the local government side. It can't be on the purely indigenous or campesino side. We actually have to sit down, hash things out, and actually agree on what it is that we're going to preserve and how it is that we're going to go about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Pro Sierra was very successful.
Very good. That's a challenge, that as well.
And what was also very interesting is that Pro Sierra and the people that worked at Pro Sierra were there in the area in all situations. When there was FARC, when there was no FARC, when there was ELN, when there was no ELN, when there were paramilitaries, when there were no paramilitaries. And so the level of trust within the population is very, very high. Mm-hmm. Because Pro Sierra has been there through the thick and the thin, and it's just, it hasn't been a fair weather friend.
Okay.
And so in that sense, it's perceived as extremely effective in terms of setting up conservation agreements with local populations.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, that's excellent about earning the trust and the effect, and that just creates a confidence. Since 1986, that's a long time ago now. I mean, that's when Colombia was due to host the World Cup, and it was given to Mexico because of the issues in the country. So think back. Mexico 86.
Yeah, this is a long time ago.
For
many expats that live here in Colombia weren't even born at that time.
Well, I was born. I was 8 years old.
We were there. I was 15 at that time.
So. But you mentioned you work with the mining companies. So you mean, how does that work? Let's say an environmental NGO and the mining company.
Well, something that's very interesting actually is that due to Colombian legislation, the mining companies have to pay for the biodiversity offsets resulting from loss of biodiversity in the areas that they operate. Mm-hmm. And this is all handled by ANLA, by the Agencia Nacional de Licencias Ambientales, and by the Ministerio de Medio Ambiente.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means, really, in actually quite simple terms, for example, is that ANLA will set up a ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, look, for every hectare that you mine, you have to compensate us with 7 hectares. And so what that has meant is that we're moving now into the 7,000 conservation hectare range in the Sierra del Perijá.
So let's say the loss of biodiversity in 1 hectare, let's say the felling of all the trees.
Filling all the trees, but
they then have to reforest 7 hectares elsewhere.
They have to manage conservation work for those 7. They have to try and do the best they can so that those 7 hectares in a nearby area, and that's all determined by ANLA and determined by the Corporaciones Regionales.
Mm-hmm.
So Corpo Cesar tells us you've got to focus on this basin or that basin. Or you've got to focus on this area or that area, depending on the priorities that they have. So it's very targeted, it's very strategic, and it's usually very effective as well. And in this case, what Pro Sierra did was that it designed a particular strategy wherein we work hand in hand again with the campesinos, with local populations, towards better, and these are called it's the conservation jargon, these are called landscape management tools.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, they've got their farm, and we come in, we talk with them, and go like, okay, you've got 20 hectares, and you're producing X, Y, and Z, so it's usually coffee and cocoa, and so why don't we try some avocado as well? Let's put in some aguacate so that your income improves, and then we do a pago por servicios ambientales as well. And then we set off by agreement with them, and it's a contract that they sign. Actually, they go like, okay, I'll set off 10 hectares of my farm purely for conservation purposes, or I'll set off 15 hectares, and then what we're going to do is we're going to set up a stand of trees that can be harvested in 15 or 20 years, and so it's very much a conservation management offset tool that we've been tweaking and tinkering around with to make it even more sophisticated and effective.
Excellent. Who are the companies, if you can mention?
It's the usual suspects. Of course, it's the companies that work in the Jaguaririco area. So it's Drummond Limited, it's Prodeco, and CNR, which is Colombian Natural Resources.
And now, look, Drummond is coal?
They're all coal up there. They're all coal.
Let's put it into context as well for my listeners and for myself, actually. The Serranía de Perijá is what comes down into Cesar, into the Department of Cesar. That's a complicated area.
Yes.
And is that, does that encroach upon places like Nabusimake and other sacred
areas?
No.
It's on the other side. On the other side, and it's actually completely outside of what the indigenous peoples call the Línea Negra.
Okay.
So there's been a lot of hoopla, for example, on mining in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. There's actually no mining whatsoever in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. What there is is concesiones de cantera.
Mm-hmm.
So these are actually for construction materials.
Cantera quarries, yeah.
These are all quarries for construction materials. So there's no coal or gold or cobalt or whatever you name it. There is no mining going on in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta.
I assume those elements do exist up in these areas.
Oh, absolutely, but still, it's. Because it's a resguardo, then you can't really do any prospecting in that sense. And also because it's a natural park as well. And right now there's, I think it's the Ministry of the Environment has a moratorium anyways on any licenses that might be submitted for the Sierra Nevada. So this is on the other side.
Yeah. You're not coming into contact with any illegal mining then up there, or...?
Every once in a while, when I'm on a walkabout in the Sierra, you do come into contact with some illegal mining.
Mm.
That's usually taken care of by the police, and so once it's reported, it's usually taken care of pretty quickly. But there's no large scale operations in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta.
Not like in San Lucas.
No. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like what you see in Antioquia. Mm. No, not
which you see
like
from
that.
The plane.
Yeah,
I mean that's the thing. You see it flying over.
Nothing like the what you see, say, like on the outskirts of many national parks.
Okay.
As well.
So now with your investigations, now you said you're sort of in control, or you're trying to set up like this water fund for Santa Marta and Cienega. How does this work? You're going to make them completely self-sufficient for water, or you're protecting the water?
That's the objective.
Okay.
It's a double to three pronged objective as usual.
Okay.
So water funds were devised by the Nature Conservancy as an investment mechanism that allows municipalities to invest in water infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Basically what this means is that as climate change has become more and more of a reality and less of the type of fake news that Trump usually touts, then what we have is that these water investments become more and more necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because in an area such as Santa Marta or Cienega, which have been declared of extremely high vulnerability to climate change, part of achieving climate change resilience involves actually investing in your water infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're going to be doing is any number of activities that are aimed at replenishing seven basins in the northern side of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. So it's the from the Rio Toribio towards the east, all the basins that are what give Santa Marta its potable water.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, Cienega is so often overlooked. But then you've got, I mean, there's a photography exhibition from someone excellent, I can't remember his name, but he did a lot of photographs in La Nueva Venecia area and stuff. And these are amongst the most polluted areas as well, these basins and estuaries. And so you're working on this.
we're working on it. And also because it was determined by a number of institutions, including the Gobernación del Magdalena, Corpamag, which are the corporaciones regionales, Tras la Perla de América is there as well, which is Carlos Vives and Claudia Elena Vázquez, his wife's foundation. We've got Prodeco as well in the governing board, and we have the Fundación Mario Santo Domingo as well. And so this is really a crucial aspect, because the way that the short-term solutions have usually been devised is that we'll just dig more wells.
Yeah.
And what that does is that the water table moves up and we have salt pollution coming in. So that can actually cause greater damage. Whereas working on your natural water infrastructure involves replenishing already occurring water that's coming into the basins. And what you're doing is protecting those basins so that they'll actually give you 12 to 15% more water within a time span of 15 years. So it's something that is long-term, but that is absolutely necessary for, say, everything that's going on in Santa Marta and in Cienega in terms of hotels, urban development, migration that we're having in the northern coast. So it's become increasingly the case that you need to invest on that water infrastructure.
No, you have this good relationship with these big mining companies, CNR, Prodeco, Drummond, etc. How do the sort of, let's say, the out and out biologists react when you say, okay, well, we're going to do this, and the landscape management and the let's say the compensations and stuff? They must come at you with a machete.
Some do. Some work with us. I mean, we work. We have a team of biologists that works with us. And so it depends on whether you fall on the fundamentalist side of things or whether you fall on the more pragmatic side of things. What's also interesting is that the mining companies have a mine closure plan. They will be gone in 12 to 15 years. And so one of the other aspects that we're working on is on transitions. And so because the mining companies have already looked at the mine closure plans, one of the more important aspects is what's going to happen to those areas that were restored once the mine companies are gone and all the infrastructure has been sold off or taken wherever mining infrastructure is taken. That becomes one huge issue because these areas, if you actually go out and take a look at them, are very well restored. So what El Cerrejón has been doing, what Prodeco, CNR, Drummond have been doing, and because the Colombian legislation is actually quite strict on this matter, they have been doing quite a bit of soil and land restoration in all those areas. So the point remains is, you know, what are we going to do with those areas once the mining companies are gone?
Well, of course, there's plenty to do. No, and I think your point lends itself very nicely to a conversation I had with three, let's say, environmentalists, experts in Sumapaz that I spoke to from the University of El Rosario. So many, many episodes ago, but after our first chat, it was last year, in fact, And so they talked about it. They were like, we're not against tourism and we're not against a certain degree of exploitation because we know it's going to happen and we know it needs to happen. And let's be realistic about it. The financial necessities of the country dictate certain things and we have to work within this. And if we can protect it, so be it. And that's it. We can't be, as you say, fundamentalist. I'm sure I'll get some hate mail, some trolls on this one, but that's fine. You know, I know you're listening. But I think one last thing, though. When we talk about ProSierra and Sierra, are you working at all in let's say, anything tourism related to exploit and perhaps benefit the region?
One of the projects that we're setting up right now is that we are actually working with a network of community-owned farms that is called the Red Ecol Sierra. The Red Ecol Sierra was set up by ProSierra a long time ago, and it became a spinoff. And it works on its own. The manager is Victor Cordero. And one of the things that we're looking into setting up with the Red Ecol Sierra is a sort of like a tourism homestay network for the area of San Pedro, San Javier, and Siberia, which is, this last one is an area where ProSierra actually has a research station, a biological research station up there. And so what we're looking into is to try and open up some of these areas to regulated tourism. really because we've got a number of campesinos out there. They, in the post-conflict, they've been mostly forgotten for the most part, and they need the income. Mm-hmm. They need to send off their kids to school. They need to send them off to college. And one of the huge issues is that they depend on the coffee harvest. And as most everyone knows, the coffee harvest can be a bit of a boom and bust cycle. And sometimes you've got some money, sometimes you've got lots of debts. And so what we're trying to do is to diversify the income for these families. Yeah. The other project that we're trying to set up is that we are actually trying to restart organic cotton production.
Wow.
As of right now, there is no organic cotton production in Colombia whatsoever.
Yeah.
So there's a huge demand in Latin America, in North America, in Central America, and in Europe for organic cotton. As of this year, it's like 20% market share. Mm-hmm. And the Sierra Nevada and the Caribbean coast were usually cotton-producing areas. There's no cotton right now. But what we're trying to set up is organic cotton production.
I know someone who would buy as well, but in the fashion industry here in Colombia. In fact, yeah. He's a guest on this show.
Yeah, there's a huge demand.
He has to go to Peru.
Yeah, they have to import the cotton either from Peru or from Turkey or from Tajikistan or from Egypt, which is pretty dumb. It's pretty dumb.
Yeah, so you have to go overseas, air miles, pollution, to import organic stuff.
The carbon footprint is just unbearable. And it's also very interesting because there's the variety that we're working with, which is called Gossypium barbadense, is the native cotton variety, extra long, stable, the one that's made into Hilditch & Key and Turnbull and Asher shirts.
Excellent. That sounds like a very productive, there's a bright future for organic coffee or organic cotton in the Sierra Nevada.
It should be. Does it
require a lot of water as well?
Well, what's interesting is that this isn't dry land cotton.
Okay.
This is a very large bush, and what it requires is abundant humidity and rainfall, which is what we have in Sierra.
Yes, abundance in drove, let's say. That's very exciting indeed. And well, we've come to an end once again, and I think it's been an incredibly, a special and informative conversation here on Colombia Calling with you, Santiago Giraldo. Remember, he's the director of the Latin American Heritage Fund and also the director of ProSierra. You can look up both of those sites online and throw some money at it.
That's always nice. I think we do good work. We do good work, and the whole point is to protect something like the Sierra Nevada Santa Marta, which was declared in 2013 the single most irreplaceable ecosystem on the planet.
That's something I didn't know at all.
Well, that's actually, well, not a lot of people know.
Wow, phenomenal. So let me take this moment to say thank you to Santiago for his time and for coming back, a second appearance on Colombia Calling. And maybe some years down the road, you'll be back on here again.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. And, the second time was even better.
Thank you very much. Flattery, as I say, always will get you everywhere. Get in touch with us at ColombiaCalling@gmail.com, Colombia Calling on Twitter, Facebook, and all the other social media ills. Thank you again for listening. We keep going from strength to strength. This is episode 230. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Colombia Calling. Goodbye.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.